Hello, this is Lacey Shrum from Vella Wood, and today I have Carol Fowler of Transmute joining me on our podcast. So, hi, Carol.
Hey, Lacey, how are you?
I'm doing so well. Thanks so much for taking the time with us today.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
Well, thanks. So, Carol and I met, I guess, about a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
At a cryptocurrency conference in Palm Springs, where we represented the state of Texas with, I think, one other person.
Yes. I think there were more Texans the second year, but the first year there was only three.
Yeah. Our representative percentage went down this year. So Carol's been in the space for a handful of years. She is CEO of a company out of Austin called Transmute. And you just have a really great story about, you know, how you've worked through this process kind of in this crazy blockchain life cycle that has, I don't know if we're in the adolescent period, maybe mid-20s of blockchain, but you just have a lot of good experience navigating the road of blockchain technology and then also being a startup and fundraising and all of those challenges. So I'm really excited to chat with you. And I think that our audience will really enjoy hearing your story.
Thank you. No, I'm excited to share it. I feel like anything with the word blockchain in it has a pretty interesting trajectory over the last couple of years.
So how did you get here? So you are a CEO of a tech company in Austin, Texas. How did you get to that place?
I co-founded the company back in March of 2017, formally, although I've been in the startup scene in Austin for my entire career, which was largely focused on biotech and semiconductor startups, which seems really far away from software, but really close to digital identity rights and privacy rights. And so how I got into blockchain was I was actually working at a semiconductor startup here in Austin, probably, I guess, now six years ago, and I oversaw our entire biotech portfolio. And what we were doing with these technologies is we were using classic semiconductor or microchip technologies and manufacturing processes in a biotech context. And so in particular, most of my customers were building things like genetic sequencing chips. And I had the opportunity in this kind of pathway to have my whole genome sequenced. And that was not like 23andMe at the time. It was a full terabyte of data, or it still is a terabyte of data, and it's literally me. And for the last several years, I have been trying to sort out how to actually own and control that data. And so this really pushed me down a rabbit hole of caring about data privacy and trying to wrap my head around the reasons why we as consumers here in America, or patients here in America rather, don't necessarily have an accessible way to own and control and manage or even monetize our data. And it kind of pushed me down rabbit holes of like regulatory compliance, data privacy laws, but also like technical concerns around how to actually store or transfer these amounts of data, these large data sets, and kind of the blend or the intersection of those two things where technical concerns meet regulation and you need to be in compliance even when you are storing or managing that data. So it was during that period that I learned about Ethereum specifically. I'd known about Bitcoin and been following data privacy stuff in that world for a little while, or since college, but really watching Ethereum come online and going through the genomic sequencing experience got me really, really interested in the implications of decentralizing or democratizing power and control of our own data, which decentralized technology can certainly help us do. So that's what got me interested. Simultaneously, the company I was working for did some Department of Defense work. So I was learning a lot about supply chain management in really high security spaces and just kind of the tax dollars that are lost there, the inefficiencies that are there, and kind of the black box of supply chain. And somewhere along the way, my co-founder, Ori Steele, and I were doing hackathons in Austin. I paid off a fair amount of my business school winning hackathons because mostly business people almost never show up for them. So only engineers show up. And we actually, what really got our start is we were building different types of identity applications on Ethereum back in 2016 when it first came out. And the thing that got us started is we built an application specifically for Syrian refugees entering Germany to help manage their integration process and their asylum process. So we wanted to provide a way for them to own things like their own resume as they entered a new country and be able to provision access to authorities to that. And so we built that proof of concept in September of 2016, and Daimler had sponsored the hackathon, which we did not realize at the time. And obviously Daimler is a German company. So we had a really interested judging panel of Germans who latched on and funded our first office space and our first early proof of concepts.
So I want to ask just a few follow-up questions to your history. In the sequencing, what is that process like and what is the result of it? You've said it's a bunch of data, but do you just, how do you have that data?
So the process of actually getting sequenced, whether it's a long or whole genome sequence or doing something like 23andMe, is largely the same. In my case, it was a blood draw. I had to get a physician's approval. So it wasn't a, you know, B2C application, and it wasn't like a saliva swab, but I actually had a blood draw. I had to have a physician sign off on it. And then when they sent me the results, they sent me an interpreted report on an encrypted flash drive that I had to go and pay a copay to sit behind my physician's desk and unencrypt to read. And that's when I realized it wasn't the raw data. It was just it's like if your doctor wrote you, you know, a pre and post surgery evaluation of what you needed to do and what they were diagnosing you with. It was the same thing. It was like, here's, you know, the different mutations you have that matter, that are clinically significant. Here's, you know, the drugs based on your genetics would work for you or not. And that was pretty much it. And so I was really disappointed that I had no data. I hadn't actually learned anything. I started emailing and asking for ways I could obtain this data. And I pretty much was told if I donated it to different researchers, they would send it to me on a hard drive. Or if I sent them a hard drive, they would send it to me back with the raw data on it. And this, we kind of went in circles for years.
That's frustrating.
Super frustrating. But candidly, I think companies, especially enterprises in spaces that are highly regulated, where there's emergent regulation, have to be really careful with how they're handling those things. And so I think it was a case where neither side of the equation really knew how to handle the situation.
Right.
And most people are getting sequenced so that they can see if they have a disease predisposition. They're not trying to play with the raw data. And so what ended up happening is over the course of the last 18 months to 2 years, I would ping them every probably 6 months. It got more and more sparse. And then it was brought to my attention that they had actually sold that division of the company, the large sequencing company, which I don't know that is relevant to name, but they sold off this division to another company. And without my consent, my data went with it. And so at this point, I was very into data privacy and consent, and so found that really interesting and continued to follow that thread. And actually, as of last week, I paid this other company $150 for them to send me my terabyte of data. And as of last week, several months later, it arrived at my door in a UPS box with no signature required. I was actually out of town. And my patient identifier is on the hard drive on a sticky note inside of the box. And that's literally all I got. And I have not even figured out how to open the files yet. So that has been the saga, of which I eventually want to kind of publish what that journey looked like, because I've definitely saved that audit trail.
Yeah, that is very concerning. I'm sure, I mean, immediately when you told me that you gave them this information, we share a lot of the same beliefs on this. I'm thinking like, well, what did you have to sign off for? Like, what does that look like? I kind of joke with anyone who's on this podcast or that I have in for what we call our blockchain breakfast, there's always room for lawyers to get involved. I'm sure that the lawyers had some hand in this being such a struggle for you to obtain.
Yes, although I am curious which lawyers were not involved when they stuck the patient identifying information on a sticky note and then put it in a normal UPS box. I was pretty shocked that literally while I was not home, my actual genome and the information needed to replicate or know a lot about me was sitting at my doorstep for days.
Just sitting on your doorstep. And then one other thing I wanted to touch on was you talked about the hackathons. Do you have a background in writing code?
I don't have a background in writing code aside from I built a few websites. So I know enough like HTML and CSS to be dangerous. I can use WordPress frameworks or Squarespace frameworks pretty effectively. But I'm the only non-engineer on my team and have always worked in highly technical fields, largely managing strategic relationships and business development type roles.
Most people don't know that hackathons, like there are not very many business people there.
No, but it's actually incredibly important because the really cool stuff that engineers are producing, sometimes if you don't have someone in the room trying to extract what the business challenges are or the social impact challenges, those cool building blocks mean nothing if they can't be applied. So that's honestly where my co-founder and I found our niche is he would tell me what he was building and what it did. And I would go find the business case that based on the information we knew about the host of the hackathon or the topic and we would fit it to that and actually pull economic data and try to model whether or not it could be a real business. And so we got pretty effective at that.
One thing that we want to talk a lot about is traceability. For those in our audience that have never really heard this word before, what does it mean and why is it important?
So we're going to talk a lot about traceability, specifically in the context of supply chain logistics for Transmute, my company's purposes. That's the industry vertical that we play the most in. But we're also going to talk a little bit about it in terms of digital identity. So right now, what we have on the internet is when you interact with any sort of service, a lot of your behaviors, your interactions, say on Facebook, are traceable, but they're traceable in a kind of one-way mirror style. A lot of people now refer to this as surveillance capitalism. It's a business model where that data and that observation and tracing your interactions on the internet is really valuable to one side of the equation today. So there's information asymmetry. And the same thing's happening outside of just individual identities and behaviors in spaces like supply chain logistics, but it's a little bit different where we have companies that need to work together and they need to track, say, your Amazon package from point A to point B, but they don't want to share all of the information. They want the asset to be traceable and they want liability to be clear and traceable, like who was responsible for that box as it moved from point A to B. But they want to have that traceability and that visibility without giving up other sensitive business information, like maybe what route they used or what service provider they used or which employee was handing off that box. And so right now, the way that a lot of our technology infrastructure works, not all the players involved are afforded the same right to the traceability information that they may want or need. And then on the supply chain side, even when there are technology platforms that help with that, a lot of it is still very manual, which means there's a lot of money lost.
Let's talk a little bit about, on an individual level, the traceability aspect. You talked about surveillance capitalism, and I think it's important for people to understand that it's not just something that you buy on Amazon that they're tracing. What other things are people giving up as they are on Amazon.com, have the app on their phone? What other data points are important to Amazon and their advertisers and merchants that customers give them?
In cases of Amazon or something like Google, they're not just looking for what you buy. They're also tracing your kind of reputation over time. So let's say you always use the one-click service or you're a Prime member and have certain habits around grocery delivery. They use all of these different behavioral inputs to close the delta or the gap between what they may predict that you want to buy and what actually happens in such a way that they can start to guarantee returns for their shareholders. So that seems really far away, but what they don't want is to not anticipate certain purchases around certain times of year or for a certain person. Say, like, if they didn't have the capability of predicting that around the holidays or Cyber Monday, they would have an influx of purchases, they would struggle to manage their warehousing. So there are some practical business reasons why they want these predictive analytics. The flip side is, as a consumer, without visibility or consent and control over what data is being collected or an awareness about that and how it's being used, we find ourselves trapped in these algorithms where now ads are being served to you to purchase a thing, and that gets as close as we can to guaranteeing that Amazon's going to have, you know, they're going to know what you're going to purchase around what time. So it slowly starts to siphon off your autonomy as an individual, which is something that is very unique to the digital sphere. Advertising and marketing doesn't work the same way when it's on a billboard as it does when it's tracing your every click or purchase online. That's what I mean when I talk about information asymmetry.
I really like that you brought up the fact about there's practical business use cases, which I think we all are a fan of here in the United States. But then really, like, when does it get blurred into where your personal identification or your personal requirements or requests or needs starts to get exploited that you didn't necessarily consent to? And there's a big question out there right now, like, what consent have we given all of these giant tech companies to really watch and follow and document our being? Okay, so let's get back to Transmute. What are you working on right now? What are some new exciting things that have come up for the next like 6 to 12 months with Transmute?
I'll kind of bring the thread from the data privacy concerns and Amazon all the way through. So while personally data privacy and consent or just promoting awareness around data mining and misuse here in the United States is definitely a huge personal motivation of mine to start the company. What we were immediately faced with in the first couple of years of the company was that that doesn't necessarily build a business model. And what I mean by that is we started out building identity products for individuals, so B2C. And I talked about the Syrian refugee use case, which even though that was an awesome proof of concept, was not necessarily Daimler's biggest interest from a business perspective. And what we found is that most of us are not used to paying for our own identities or applications. And conceptions around identity vary widely, and they're very relative to other things that you're talking about. Maybe it's your employer, it's the government. And so there's this concept in our space called self-sovereign identity, which is generally blockchain-powered identity that is focused on making the individual their own sovereign, owning, controlling all their consent to data mining and use. And we found that that was not a profitable business model. And we also found that trying to sell that here in the United States got us virtually nowhere.
I rant and rave about this all the time with like hardcore facts to back it up, and nobody really cares or wants to listen.
No. And, you know, the fact of the matter is like we live in a very consumer, we are, you know, a capitalist consumer focused nation. In a lot of ways, most of the, a lot of the globe is, although it varies drastically by geography. In America, I would say we're the most extreme and convenience wins. So consumers want an easy user experience. They're not necessarily clued into the attention economy with regards to stuff like Facebook or surveillance capitalism, like with Google and Amazon. They care about the user experience, the convenience of having a package delivered immediately. And I'm certainly not unique to that. I care about those things too. But what we found is a couple things. Enterprises were very interested in more secure and efficient ways of managing the identities in their ecosystems, whether those were asset identities, like in the case of an Amazon box, or those were vendor or employee identities in the case of other ecosystem partners. They were very interested in that. And they're interested in that because they're losing a lot of money managing the logistics of coordinating, having to collaborate with so many different parties in this kind of 24/7 hyper-connected world that cares a lot about convenience and consumption. And there's lots of new regulation like GDPR in Europe or California Consumer Privacy Act coming online next year in California that are mandating that these companies care more about user rights. But they don't want to care about those user rights here in America at the expense of serving the same global scale of a customer base or value to their shareholders. And so what we kept running into was selling them a loss of control over their customers' data was not going to get us anywhere. It was the one thing enterprises did not want to hear. So now where we're at with Transmute is we build enterprise-grade decentralized identity products, largely for supply chain logistics organizations. And the sell is more about managing the auditability and the liability of a chain of custody, like a box moving from point A to point B and all the points that it's changed hands. And it's about efficiency. So it's way more about the boring old sell that has nothing to do with blockchain. That's about automating processes, making them more efficient, and basically reducing costs and increasing margins, which is very business friendly. And it is a true value of our product and the underlying technological innovation. But it definitely took us some hard lessons to get there.
Yeah, I mean, totally understandable. It's a long road and it's just difficult to predict what people want until you're really out there on the street trying to sell it. So what I was going to ask is about the use of blockchain.
When I say we're building decentralized identity products for the enterprise, the real innovation is actually something called distributed public key infrastructure, public key cryptography, which is a really well-understood technical concept that's used across pretty much most of the applications and institutions that we interact with and have on the internet for the last couple of decades. However, you can also use a blockchain to generate distributed identities and distributed identifiers. And the utility of using a blockchain in order to do that is increased traceability and increased auditability. Because as probably most of your listeners have heard, blockchain is an immutable database or an immutable ledger that's distributed across lots of different nodes, such that all of the parties who have those nodes can see the same series of hashes or series of events in the same order at any given time, which means that they're always looking at the same information. So in a supply chain context, why that auditability or that blockchain layer is very useful is because what they want to know is who was liable for that asset when. And that is currently information that's incredibly opaque or completely manual, such that they're handing off pieces of paper as they go around, which is not an efficient or a reliable audit log for a lot of different reasons. And so we often get asked, can you do decentralized identity without a blockchain? And the answer is yes, you can. And we do have a tool out there that users can check out called GitHub DID that is a decentralized identity tool that for software supply chains that doesn't use a blockchain at all. It just uses public-private key pairs for signing your GitHub commits. But you don't need an auditability layer necessarily for that. For all of our customers in supply chain logistics, they want decentralized identities that have been generated DPKI and anchored to a blockchain because they want that increased traceability of who was responsible for this asset when.
Yeah, I always like to think about it. It goes back to the why Bitcoin needed this, you know, solution to the double spend. Everyone has their different ledgers, and every time you have a different ledger, it means a different process and it also means a different audit in between. So the use of blockchain really cuts down on those.
Exactly. And I think another misconception about decentralized identity and traceability and blockchain in general has to do with trust. So there's lots of trust assumptions you make with any project in the space. And a lot of people think about, okay, we're implementing trust, we're codifying trust. But the reality in a space like supply chain logistics is these contracts are paper negotiated with enterprises and lawyers, and that trust is already codified. And especially in logistics relationships and trust relationships are incredibly important. But what that auditability layer lets you do is enforce the contracts you've already agreed to. So it's a trust enforcement layer that expedites liability disputes over whether or not you should settle on a bonus because maybe that oil pipeline pumped out the right amount according to the contract without having to go to court and dispute that or take a couple weeks for settlement. Or maybe that Amazon box was delivered to the wrong location. And so it helps settle disputes of liability and enforce trust agreements that you've already negotiated up front.
Yeah, we talk a lot about it also prevents a lot of like accidental breach because you can have things built in, like you said, the lost package. It's a very basic example, but let's say you're talking about a lost shipment that's, you know, a couple hundred million dollars. The timing and the delivery of that is very important. And even though the two parties trust each other to go into a contract, when it comes down to the timing and delivery, that can cause problems on either one's end and cost the other money. That's an important point that could cause contention and could cost a lot of money and just diligence and research to prove one thing or another that the audit ability can cut down on.
Exactly. And then, of course, the compliance aspect. When you have an immutable audit trail, it makes compliance with a lot of the emerging privacy and traceability regulations a lot easier to stomach without needing to totally expand your compliance teams.
So does that lead us into where you are right now with Transmute and what you are working on?
Yeah, no, that's a good segue. As I mentioned, we spent a long time trying to initially sell B2C decentralized identity to an enterprise. It dawned on us that enterprises really needed easier compliance. They needed more efficient processes. And the last thing that they needed technically was any solution they're going to adopt needs to integrate with their existing infrastructure because they've already made investments that are addressing their customer base at a scale that they can't afford to lose. So what our solution does, Transmute ID, is bridge the centralized and the decentralized worlds. And so what we're doing in supply chain logistics and the use case that I'm most excited to talk about is asset traceability and credential digitization in supply chain logistics using a decentralized identity product called Transmute ID that goes in and we integrate with an enterprise's existing infrastructure, which is usually an identity system like OpenID Connect or Active Directory, which are the two most famous or popular identity building blocks. Companies like Okta are built on OpenID Connect, which your listeners may be familiar with. And from there, those systems or the identity providers are where all the existing identities and an enterprise ecosystem live. So we're talking about employees, vendors, corporate identities, which would be the vendors. And we integrate using an API with those systems. And then we inextricably link the identities in those systems to decentralized identifiers that are tracked on a blockchain of your choice. So this could be private permission ledger or public. We don't care. We're very agnostic. Enterprises also don't like vendor lock-in. But once you have decentralized identifiers linked to identities in your system, now you can automatically trace the movements of those identities. So let's say you want to know every time a truck driver picks up and drops off a load or hands it off. That's an event that we can trigger to be tracked for that identity on a blockchain. The customer we're able to talk about most broadly is DHS. So recently, Department of Homeland Security announced that we are working with them and Customs Border Protection, specifically the Office of Trade, to help do this for our steel imports here in the United States. So it may come as a surprise to a lot of listeners, it was to me, that a lot of our import processes are still on paper. That means there's a lot of places for things like forgery and counterfeiting and just simply miscommunication and inefficiency. And so what we're actually doing with them is using Transmute ID to start to provide decentralized identifiers that are tracked on a blockchain to these nation states and vendors like importers or the manufacturer of the steel. So today, the way that process works is iron ore is imported from somewhere and a manufacturer smelts it, turns it into the steel that we may use in our buildings here in the U.S., and then it's imported. And once it's done being manufactured, there's a paper steel mill certificate that they have to assess, you know, the chemical makeup of the steel, the strength of it, you know, is it up to spec and compliance? And it's a piece of paper that's then manually signed off on. And then when it gets to imports, Customs Border Protection, they rely on that paperwork and the accuracy of it. They sign off on the review, and then it's manually input, you know, into our the rest of the databases that track what's being imported. And there's a huge problem with enforcing tariffs, as well as ensuring the safety and verifying that, say, Canadian steel, or what this steel mill certificate may say is Canadian steel, is actually Canadian steel. So we, as the United States, have a lot of trade agreements. We want to know, did the steel come from someone that we, you know, that is part of NAFTA, because those duties are going to look different. And that's very difficult to do in the way that the manual process works today. And so we are giving each of these entities decentralized identifiers, and we're supporting existing government systems to help build a bridge or a kind of an on-ramp to this more digital identity and verifiable credential process.
That's super cool and just super fascinating piece of the economy and infrastructure that most people probably don't understand or know a lot about.
Yeah, no, I knew a little bit, and the more I learn, the more surprised I am.
Yeah. And then so once the paper is as the process is now, I'm assuming it's mostly paper from start to finish, and you are using Transmute ID, cutting down on a lot of the manual processes. How are you handling that? It sounds like you're not just like globally going out and going to build this huge program to encompass the entire process. Are you deciding certain places where you can sort of cut away at processes and make them easier and more automatic? How has that process worked with the entities that you are forming relationships with?
What Transmute ID is, aside from the decentralized identity piece that I mentioned, is it also provides a guided experience for setting up automatic workflows for an enterprise. So probably the best analog is you can imagine like Box, the storage company. They have a really good widgetized guided experience for setting up enterprise workflows. We have a similar GUI tool that sits on top of our decentralized identity technology that helps customers like Customs Border Protection say, okay, the process that we follow for importing steel or generating a steel mill certificate is this. And it walks them through digitizing that process such that now anytime a vendor or maybe an importer needs to be onboarded into the system, the same process will happen each time. And then what's happening on the back end is that we integrate not only with the existing identity provider, but also whatever their storage mechanism is. So generally, this is a cloud storage solution like Google Cloud or Oracle Cloud or AWS, any number of the big cloud providers we integrate with. Today, our base level solution is Box. So out of the box, you can store documents in Box. And the reason we need to integrate with existing storage solutions as well is not just for scale, but it's because these manual processes are basically the easiest way to digitize them first is to add cryptographic signatures to PDFs. So candidly, when it's as manual as paper-based, we're starting with creating verifiable credentials out of identities that have signed off on a regular paper certificate of some sort, because we have to get that paper into the system somehow. And we can't expect the government or enterprises to accept fully digitized credentials overnight. We have to insert ourselves where the process is today. So that's how we're managing the onboarding process.
So that's another service offering of yours is the, are you calling it Transmute Box? Or what are you calling it?
We call it Transmute ID and the Transmute Workflow Engine. So, and kind of a little bit more about the workflow engine, even though the identity piece is repeatable and standard, what we learned in our product market fit research is that no one enterprise shares the same workflows. However, all of the workflows that we have encountered, so everyone wants something custom. And obviously as a startup, you can't build everyone something custom. And so what we spent a lot of time trying to understand is how do business processes, like what are the Lego blocks that they break down into? And what we found is that it's largely two different behaviors. One is signing and one is sharing. And there's some nuances around that. But for the most part, let's take an example like onboarding a truck driver or a new employee with HR. They need to sign off on seeing things like your driver's license or your training credentials so that you can work there. And then they need, in that process, you to share those credentials with them for them to attest to. And they need to share them with maybe their safety coordinator to ensure compliance. And so those two behaviors can be layered on each other in a variety of ways to power, quote unquote, custom workflows. And those are really the only two Lego blocks we use. And that's what the entire workflow engine and guided experience is built around.
So you talked a little bit about Transmute Workflow and onboarding your different clients to your system. Is that another product offering of yours? And how has that been to build out? I don't imagine everyone's systems are easily compatible with each other. So what has that process looked like for you?
It's a really good question. And it's actually one of the bigger concerns with information sharing, especially in supply chain logistics, is nobody's using the same processes or systems. So even though the core Transmute ID, the core technology behind it that powers the decentralized identity and the integrations with it, their existing identity systems is repeatable and standard at this point, the overlay, which is the enterprise workflow, as we call it, or just a business process, is, like you said, completely unique for each business. So we spent a little over a year working through product market fit research, trying to understand what is the commonality among business processes, and specifically in supply chain logistics, or any sort of kind of chain of custody. And what we found is that you can distill any business process to or workflow down to two fundamental building blocks. One is signing and the other is sharing. And so an example of this in the supply chain logistics context is onboarding, say, a new truck driver or a vendor. In the truck driver use case, we need to get him into the company or into the system. And today you have an HR person and a safety coordinator who need to review information that the truck driver shares, and they need to sign off on it. In standards language, they need to attest to it and actually add their cryptographic signature to it. And then they need to share that up the chain to maybe their safety coordinator and have that information available for auditing and compliance. And so that's a really simple onboarding use case. But those two building blocks, signing and sharing, can be layered on each other in a variety of different ways to power a variety of different workflows and use cases. Kind of circling back to the customer use case that we talked about with regards to CBP and DHS, you have a situation where you want an importer or a steel manufacturer to share their business credentials, like their articles of incorporation or their location or whatever information is needed, with someone who can certify or sign off on seeing those and those being accurate, and then share those with the next handoff point in the chain of custody, be it the, you know, a logistics provider or the Customs Border Patrol agent. And when the Border Patrol agent reviews that information, and in our world, we call that a verifiable credential because it's cryptographically secure once it's in our system. When they review that, they sign off on their review before they let the import in. So that's a kind of oversimplified view of the workflow engine, but what we basically have powered is a guided experience for helping enterprises add on, you know, how many signing and sharing components are part of this workflow that they're trying to automate and track.
Okay, so it sounds like y'all have been very, very busy. What is next for Transmute, and really, what are the barriers to adoptions you're dealing with? What's like the next hurdle in your startup journey that you are sort of climbing that you need to get over at this point?
I'm going to speak from the decentralized identity space first. So one of the reasons we chose supply chain logistics as our first vertical to go to market in is because over 80% of companies in that space are digitizing today, and they don't want to digitize themselves into more information silos, because to operate more efficiently and capture more revenue, they need to share information more effectively without compromising their IP. And there's a high burden of coordination and a lot of liability disputes. So it's a really good space to add emerging digital technology that helps solve those problems today. But in terms of adoption of a solution like ours, there are three primary barriers. The first one I touched on a little bit when we talked about us struggling to sell into enterprise early on, and that's integration with legacy systems. Enterprises and governments have already made significant investments in their digital infrastructure. There's already a lot of internet standards through like the World Wide Web Consortium, other organizations like IEEE and NIST and whatnot around these technologies, and you cannot ask them to rip and replace. It's not an efficient business decision. It's not a decision they're going to make. So we have to have solutions that integrate with existing systems and build a bridge to these new business models. The second barrier to adoption is actually decentralized identity interoperability. So Transmute ID can help you generate verifiable credentials, but if you can't move those credentials to another system, then it will be really difficult to create the efficient market in terms of especially logistics that we want to create. And one of the advantages of decentralized identity, or one of the business problems that a lot of enterprises are looking at decentralized identity solutions to solve, is they want an identity that persists across heterogeneous or very disparate applications. So when one company owns lots of different, say, mobility services or service offerings, today, the way centralized systems work, they often have your redundant PII in those systems. And so they are looking for an identity that can persist across them without putting them at risk by having a bunch of redundant data. And that's something that DIDs can solve for, or decentralized identities, but all the companies in our space need to be built on standards, just like existing internet infrastructure is built on, so that we can interoperate. And there are a lot of standards.
Similar to email.
Exactly. And there's
all the emails work together regardless of what system that you're using.
Exactly. So that's one barrier. And Transmute, my co-founder, is actually the chair of interoperability at the Decentralized Identity Foundation. And we're highly involved in the W3C emerging standards around decentralized identities. And so that work is going on and is publicly accessible. The third barrier to adoption is government buy-in. And the reason that government buy-in is a barrier is because when you think about what your individual identity in life is based on, or your corporate identity, today it's based on a few foundational credentials that the government issues, and the rest of your credentials and mobility and access is predicated on that. So an example of this is a driver's license or a social security card or articles of incorporation. And for better or for worse, that is our sovereign nation states are the ones who issue those foundational credentials today. And so without starting there and having their buy-in on digital identity, we cannot build the new future that we collectively hope for. What's really exciting about, and I think our work with DHS and CBP is indicative of this, is they're very interested and bought in solving these problems. And they understand how this benefits them in terms of increased traceability and securing our own, you know, economic position in the world by having more visibility into this and having more standardized and efficient ways of tracing identities and sharing data. And what's really cool also about the early government buy-in today is that they are also incredibly focused on interoperability and integration with legacy systems and standards. In fact, that was a requirement for doing business with them.
That's very encouraging to hear.
Yes, yes.
That they have that on their mindset.
Super exciting. Yes, no, that was a requirement across all the teams that they have funded to work in these spaces. And so I think what we're seeing and what we're going to see rapidly in 2020 and 21 is all three barriers being attacked at once. All the dominoes are falling. My team in particular has been kind of ringing this bell for a long time. And now we're interoperating. We integrate with legacy systems and the government is adopting. So yes, it's exciting.
Yeah, that feels good.
Yes, exactly.
We talk about it feels like you're putting together just little tiny puzzle pieces all over. And then at some point, like they all start clicking and it feels really, really good.
Yes, yes. I wish we would click even faster, but yes.
All right. So that wraps up our time with Carol. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And thank you everyone for listening to the VeloWood podcast. If you have any questions, concerns, or want to know more information about the world of blockchain and cryptocurrency, check out our website and blog. And we're always open to comments. Thank you.